I failed in the first service. So there we go. It's out. It's on the table. You can know this in advance. I was trying to get to the end of chapter 5, 25, sorry. That means we got to start in 24, finish the last little bit, get all the way to the end of chapter 25 of Matthew. I did not make it. And so what I told first service is that next week, it's going to be a really strange start to our service. I'm going to talk at the start of next week's sermon about hell. It's not usually how we sort of launch into a sermon, but that's the part that I didn't get to as we work through this passage, that Jesus is teaching us through a series of stories about his coming and some of the consequences of that, both good in terms of the reward he will bring and difficult in terms of the judgment he will bring. And so if you've got questions, if you have issues that you have been wrestling through, this is your week. Shoot me an email and I will maybe try to incorporate that into what I have to say next week, because it's an important topic. And many of us, I know, wrestle with it, try to struggle to fit the pieces of how all those things work, how God's justice and mercy and all those things weave together. But I do think I will be able to get through most of the chapter. And the main reason I can do that is because Jesus is going to tell four short stories that all essentially aim at communicating the same point. And so we're going to walk through them as efficiently as we can, and I'm going to try to point out some of the key moments through these stories. Now, again, I said to the first service, every time I come to this chapter, I'll just let you know what goes through my head. And it's a strange kind of comparison, but every time I read through this passage, I think of my wife going away to various women's retreats over the years. I don't know if any of you gals have done that or any husbands have had your wives go away. Back in the day, it was actually safer because when our kids were home, if the house was slightly chaotic, there was sort of someone to blame. Harder these days. It's like, you went away and I'm sorry about the mess. I'm not sure who made it. I mean, that just falls on deaf ears. But I do know, and here's kind of the reason why my brain thinks about this, is every time she would go away, I'd always say things like, you know, when are you going to be home? Now, in part, because I love having my wife home, just for the record. Like, that's no joke at all. Like, that is, I'm okay with women's retreats, but it's like, but there's a part of me that hates them, losing my wife for the weekend. But the other part of asking the question is because I know how the weekend's going to go. We will eat. We will make food. And then we will slowly pile up the dishes on the counter. And then I will do the reverse math. I'm like, okay, she's going to be home by 3. It's going to take me about an hour to deal with this mess. Give myself a little buffer, right, in case something goes wrong in the dishwashing duties. And then a little bit more so that things can dry a little bit. So it's not completely obvious what's happened. Then when she comes home, it's all ready. I read this story, these series of stories of Jesus talking about his return. And the one important thing we need to bear in mind is Jesus is explicit on this. I will return, but you don't know when. Therefore, live a prepared life. The equivalent would be my wife saying, I am going to come home, but Don, you don't know when. So don't let the dishes build up. Now, last week we were in chapter 24, and we came to the two therefore moments. The first in verse 42, where Jesus is talking about the fact that we do not know the day and the hour. And that language is going to become important because that's the language Scripture often uses speaking about his return, about the end of all things. And Jesus will pick up on that through this series of stories. No one knows the day or the hour. That's verse 36. And then he talks about the fact that we don't know that, that it will be unexpected, that it will be sudden, it will be glorious. Therefore, verse 42, stay awake, for you do not know on what day the Lord is coming. That's the takeaway. That's the therefore. It's like, don't miss that. You might have lots of other things to think about in terms of Christ's return and all those kind of things. Don't miss the fact you don't know the hour, so stay awake, be prepared. In fact, verse 44, after he talks through a little scenario, almost like a little parable or vignette, verse 44, he gives us his second therefore. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So, what's the takeaway? You don't know, So be prepared. Don't lose sight of that reality. Now, there are two ditches, kind of like, you know, as you're walking down, you know, the road of life, you can go into the ditch of like becoming overly obsessed about these things, and it's all you think about, where scripture is full of all sorts of wonderful things to think about. On the other hand, you can go into the other ditch where you just never think about that. And actually, it's interesting, if you ever read through the New Testament, as particularly into the epistles where, you know, it's Paul and Peter and James writing letters to various churches. If you sometime have the time to do it, read through some of those letters through the lens of, did these people live in light of the confidence that Christ was going to return or not? And I think you'll actually discover something very, very fascinating, that the churches who seem to have the clarity and the focus on that were walking well with Jesus. The churches that had lost sight of that, particularly if you read through Corinthians, you'll see that in spades. They're the ones that are starting to drift from Christ, starting to lose themselves in sin, starting to walk away from his authority. So very, very important. That's the point. Verse 42, 44, don't forget. He's coming back. Be prepared. Now, these four stories, I think, give us a picture, a description of what being prepared looks like. That's kind of how they're all going to function. The first one from verse 45 to the end of the chapter is the shortest. And it's actually, what's interesting about this story is it's like, as we're reading through what Jesus has to say, the story is upon us before we even really realize what's happening. He goes from verse 44 to right into the story, verse 45. Who then is the faithful and wise servant? And start paying attention to the language. I'll try to point out some of this. The terms that Jesus will use and has been using up to this point in Matthew, particularly from verse chapter 23 on, will start to kind of be like threads woven all through this. This idea of faithfulness, this idea of wisdom, when he talks about the day, he talks about the hour. He's often going to, in all of these stories, there's going to be mention of the delay part of the story. So, who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has set over his household to give them food at their proper time? So the real quick synopsis, or the real quick sort of situation Jesus has set up, he's like, there's a master, and he set a servant over his household, a household type servant who's going to make sure that people are cared for. And here is here's the application. Here's sort of the takeaway. Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if the wicked servant says to himself, my wife is at women's retreat and she's not coming back very quickly. And so, no, that's the compare. Here's what Jesus says. My master is delayed and he begins to beat his fellow servants, eats and drinks with drunkards. Then the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect and an hour he does not know. He will cut him in pieces, put him with the hypocrites in place where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now you start to see in a real quick little story, some of the key ingredients. There is a master who goes and then comes, and he has authority over the servants of his household. That's kind of the situation. And how this servant prepares or lives in readiness according to his master's instruction has great bearing on what happens next, for wonderful good or for consequence. And that's going to be the plot line of all of these little stories. So the next two, I think, are the longer ones. So we'll maybe spend a little bit longer in them and then see if we can kind of pull out some applications at the end. Verse 1 of chapter 25. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Now, this is the first time in Matthew where Jesus is giving a parable about what the kingdom will be like. He's often given us parables up to this point where he says, the kingdom of heaven is like, and he relates his kingdom to something that is more familiar to us. But this time you can see what he's doing. He's saying, I'm not talking about what it will be like at a particular moment. The moment is when he returns. So the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish. Again, now we have, again, our foolish and wise language. Five are foolish, five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. The wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, again, there's that language of delay, of Jesus essentially helping us understand that he is going to go and he will come back. But between the going and the coming, there's this consistent teaching that there will be time, there will be delay. In fact, some people might even start to say things like, you know what? He's been gone 2,000 years. We're not sure he's ever going to come back. Jesus says, don't think for a second that the delay becomes a problem to my return. So, bridegroom was delay. They all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight, there was a cry. Here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. An unexpected time. This is not one wedding. The whole kind of scenario here is the unexpected strangeness. Like, who gets married at midnight? There's been a delay. It's unexpected. Here's the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Then all the virgins rose, trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready, again, ready, prepared, watching, right? That's that idea. They're ready, went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterwards, the other virgins came also saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. And he answered, truly, I say to you, I do not know you. And some of you who have been here through this whole series, if you remember all the way back to Matthew chapter 7, you're going, hold on a second. That is exactly the way Jesus has spoken to people at a different opportunity, a different moment, who had rejected him, rejected his lordship, not followed his teaching, who said, Lord, Lord, did we not do all these things? And he will say, depart from me. Why? What's the basis of the judgment? I never knew you. The relationship, I never knew you. Verse 13 is the application, the therefore moment. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. There's the language again. The day, the hour of my coming. Now, the reason this one's a little bit strange for us is we don't do weddings like they did weddings 2,000 years ago. I've done lots of wedding ceremonies over the years. I know enough to know kind of roughly how they go down. There's variations. There's little tweaks. People try to be creative and keep it fresh. But essentially, the gal, the bride, is the star of the show. That's how it works. She's got a spectacular dress. The groom, he usually comes out over there. In fact, most of the guests who are in the room as it's going on, like, you know, they aren't really even aware that he's kind of entered the stage. Like, they're visiting, and then the poor guy who's, like, super nervous, all of a sudden he comes out with some guys, and people start noticing he's there, and he's standing there. Now, there's no special music. No one stands at that moment. They just carry on. And then eventually, when everything's ready, special music starts. And the bridesmaids come out, and they line up over here. Doors get shut, and then I say something like, would you please all rise, right? And what happens next? The bride comes in, because she's the star of the show, and she comes up, and everything's focused. Everyone stands. Pictures happen, and she comes up, and we stand. That's how weddings work. 2,000 years ago, it was very different. Keep your mouth shut, done. Very different. We'll just say that. The groom was the star of the show. Now, the reason for it is that because the formation of a household was very much focused around the groom. He was the one creating the new household, and so all the attention was on him. Bride, less so. And so his presence, his coming, was the important moment of the ceremony, if we were to kind of describe it. And so he would come, and the entourage with him would be the group of younger women. In our passage, they're described as virgins. So they're young, they're of marriageable age, and they would come from whatever the village or town, and they would accompany him. And it was both to kind of create that festive sort of celebration and also a signal of their readiness to be married. And so it's all part of the culture and part of the importance of this moment. We do some acknowledgements of that. If you've ever been to a wedding where they throw the bouquet and, you know, whoever catches it's going to get married next, that kind of stuff. Kind of, there's sort of some loose comparisons to that moment. And so in our story, we have a groom who's come along. His coming is at a strange time. We have the group of young women of the town who are anticipating being part of this, but they have these lamps. Now, a lamp, and again, in the story, this would be roughly, this is just an imitation. This is not authentic. But roughly like that, which helps us understand when they're talking about, hey, would you share some of the oil with us? Don't picture your big Coleman thing with the big reservoir, because if you picture that, you're reading the story going, man, those gals were not nice. Why didn't they just share a little bit of the oil? You'd realize if that's it, and they're saying, could we have some? It's like, okay, if we divide this in half, neither of us, there's not going to be light for either of us. We're going to run out. So just be careful of kind of what you're picturing as you think through this scenario. But you start to see kind of now this whole thing unfold. The modern equivalent, like if we could put it in modern terms, I think it would be something like this. The bride's ready for her big day. And the gals are all going to get there on the Saturday morning because the wedding's coming up later that day. And they're going to do their hair and they're going to get dressed together and they're going to do the makeup. And the bridesmaids are going to meet the bride and then they're going to come in some nice cars and they'll all get out together, right? That happens sometimes. I'm not saying every time, but that's fairly typical kind of wedding kind of process. Can you imagine if the bride woke up and her bridesmaids didn't show up? Time for hair, time for makeup, time to get dressed. They just don't show. They're sleeping in. And then they just never show. They don't come in the car. She comes on her own. And so they're like, okay, we're just going to do the wedding anyway. And so she comes up and we're halfway through the wedding. And all of a sudden a car comes screeching in and a carload of gals come stumbling out and they're bedhead and wearing sweat clothes. And they're like, hey, we want to come in and stand at the front. You would understand. We would be saying, you know what? That's not the way to honor your friend. You don't get to just jump in the middle of the ceremony just because you want to. This is kind of what's going on in the story. These gals show up late, unprepared. Knock, 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 let us in. We want to be part. The answer is no. And the point is, because you don't know the hour, the day of Christ's return, don't be foolish and live an unprepared life. Now, at this point in the series of stories, we still don't know what it is that we are to do, which leads us to the next story. The next story, for it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them with his property. We're kind of back to the master-servant kind of analogy here. To one, he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another one. This is interesting, each according to his ability. So sometimes we interpret this one wrongly. We go, oh, the talents must be like the abilities that God gives us, so we need to use our abilities well. Or we really twist it further and turn it into some sort of weird quasi-Jesus financial advice. None of that's the point. The point is, he is going to come back, and we need to think really clearly of the implications of that. A talent is a weight of gold, typically. So it's almost like what we would kind of describe as a denomination of a certain type of currency. The point of this one is not that this is an uncommon practice. Oftentimes, this is what would happen in the ancient world. You would be perhaps over top of an area of land and a state, and you would travel, and you would leave people to manage it in your absence. The shocking part of this is the sums we're talking about. A talent of gold in today's currency is between, depending on conversion and all those kind of things, between $3 and $4 million US. One guy is handed $20 million. I'm going away. Would you just take care of this for me? Most of us, oh, yes, I will take care of this for you, right? The next guy gets his talents, and the third guy, his talents, according to their ability. Now, if we had lots of time to think about this, I think we would want to be thinking about, like, what are the things that God entrusts to us? Certainly the gospel, the message of salvation and hope. But he does entrust many things to us. Some of them are the resource type things, just like the houses, the resources, the opportunities, the education. Some of you have had amazing experiences in life that God has entrusted to you to use. Some of it is the abilities and the skills that he's entrusted to you. All of those things are to be used for his glory. Now, in the story, here's what I think is interesting. And I underline things in my Bible, and then when I run out of space is when it's time to get a new Bible. That's sort of how it works in my world. I find verse 16 to be important because I think there's a little phrase in there that's easy to miss. Here's how it goes. He who had received the 5 talents went at once. Instant obedience. It's easy to miss the when at once moment, isn't it? Oh, we know the plot line. He goes, he takes the 5, he makes 5 more by wisely trading and investing. And so when the master comes back, he's like, here's 10. The one who has 2, he goes away and he does something with his 2. So when the master comes back, he's able to say, here's 4. The one who has 1 doesn't do anything with it. He digs a hole and buries it. And when the master comes back, he's like, here's your 1. We often don't just kind of stop for a moment and think of this at once type of obedience. So the story unfolds, right? They go, they do the business with this whole thing, and then the master returns. Again, get the themes. Master's going, master's coming. And again, we're told in verse 19, it's after a long time. The master gone, In one story, he's delayed. In the next story, it's a long time. You start to kind of get sort of some of these key themes running through this story. He came and he settled his accounts with them. Then we fast forward to this great moment where the master takes this one who has made five extra talents and he's going to reward him. And here's what he says in verse 21. Three rewards. Here they are. Number one, well done, good and faithful servant. Never underestimate the power of praise, the power of your words. One day to live, to hear Jesus say to you, well done. What an awesome moment that will be. Isn't that what, that's what compels us to want to honor him. Also interesting, and just tuck it away, it's not certainly the point of the story, but even the power of your own words, and we're thinking, you know, of this family discipleship thing. I mean, you know, because you're probably like me, that there are things that you were told when you were a kid that you remember to this day. It's a fascinating thing. The power of words to hurt and destroy, but also to build up. Well done, good and faithful servant. Reward number two, one. Reward number two, you have been faithful over little, I will set you over much. The second reward is actually increased responsibility. And most of us, I don't think when we think of heaven, you know, you hear those sort of, almost sort of, I don't know, they're kind of comical versions of it, of like, one day we will go to heaven. There'll be streets of gold and this big mansion. And we tend to think of like, oh, my reward's going to be this big, glorious white house on a hillside. And then we read what Jesus has to say, and here's your reward. I'm going to give you more responsibility. That's the honor. That's the reward. And actually, I think if we were to think about it long enough and think about what an eternity just sitting in a big white house with nothing to do, we would understand there's something empty in that. And instead, the opportunity is there that for all of eternity, we will be able to do things in service of Christ in proportion to how we have honored him in this life. Third reward. And again, maybe easy to read over or miss this one. Here it is. Enter into the joy of your master. I don't know what your view of God is. If your God is a joyful God. If he's not, I suspect he's very hard to follow. God is a joyful God. This is not the only place in Scripture that teaches it, but there are these point blank moments where we see just with perfect clarity, Jesus is saying, and it's the last, notice it's the last reward, like, and rewards tend to build. You don't start with the best prize. It's like, I am going to give you a brand new house. And oh, by the way, you also get, you know, I don't know, we're going to pay your insurance for 3 years. No, you build, like, we're going to pay your insurance. We're going to give you a car and get a new house. There's a building, praise, responsibility, and what's the greatest reward of all? Enter into my joy. My joy will be your joy. We have a joyful God. And one day we will be brought into that if we trust Christ. So there's the rewards. There's the scene. If you kind of continue to read through the story, you see the second guy gets the same reward. The third guy's brought in. He has not done anything with his money. But you're going to see now the reason if you jump forward into verse 24. He also, who received one talent, came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid. I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here's what's yours. But his master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gathered where I've scattered no seed. You knew that this is who you knew me to be. Notice it's posed as a question. It's posed almost like dripping sarcasm. Because everything we've learned in this story so far is that is not the master. What's his reward? It's like, enter into my joy. He has spectacularly entrusted massive resources into the hands of these servants. He's like, and now he returns like, that's who you thought me to be? A hard man? A cruel man, essentially? Well, because of that, then you will get the consequence. You will essentially be treated by me the way you thought you knew me to be. Take the talent from him. Give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has more will be given. One who has given to the one who has abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. Cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Notice in all of the stories, there's a consequence. There is massive reward, spectacular reward. And there is severe consequence. Point seems to be pretty clear. So live prepared. Next week, like I said, we're going to talk about some of the consequence piece. The final story, though, goes like this. And the final one is actually interesting because it actually doesn't have all the features of what we'd normally expect a parable to be. And I'm honestly not sure. Up to now, you can kind of see how they're parables. Jesus is like, I'm like a master. I'm like a groom. This one, it lacks some of that, right? Verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. He's not saying this is like a comparison. He's actually saying this is actually what will happen. Now, in this last account, not even quite sure what the right word is, you'll see some elements that do seem like parable, where he refers to himself as a shepherd and people like sheep and goats. So it's hard to quite know exactly, but it seems to be that we're getting closer and closer to actually the reality of the situation. Before him, verse 32, will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates sheep from the goats. Every once in a while, I've run into people who have asked me, or it's actually less a question. It's more of a statement, because I believe Jesus is fully God, worthy of all glory. And I've had people like, well, when we read the New Testament, when we read the Gospels, it seems like you are putting words in Jesus' mouth. And I would just respond by saying, if that's where your struggle is, just open the New Testament and read what Jesus says. Just read plainly his claims. Think for a moment of what he's just claimed in this story. He has claimed that he is the equivalent of a master and we all are servants. And servant is a very generous word. It's actually slave. Servant makes us feel like, you know, like at least I'm a butler. It's like, no. You're a slave. You don't even own yourself. Think of, if he's just a man, think of how brazen that claim is. I'm the master of everyone. Or think of this. He has just said, when I come, it will be this. All the nations will gather before me, and I will separate them out, and I will determine their eternal destiny. Like, if he's just a man, I don't know what you'd do with those kind of claims. Think back in Matthew chapter 11 when John the Baptist is in prison and he's wrestling. Like, who is Jesus the one? And Jesus has a bit of a conversation. But after that, there's this strange little moment where Jesus talks about John and he says this, there has been no one greater than John the Baptist to ever step foot on this planet. That's pretty high praise. You want to know the reason he gives? It's because John prepared the way for me. And again, you have to just kind of wrestle with some of those things and the implication of those kind of claims. Because if I ever got in front of you and said, you know what, Peter, you always get picked on Peter because you're so right front and center. Peter, you are the greatest man to have ever lived. You want to know why? Because Peter is preparing the way for me. You would go, that is the most supreme gross arrogance, but Jesus says it. And no one bats an eye because they understand that they are standing in the presence of God himself. You have to wrestle with some of those things. Back to our little story here. All of the judgment that's to come in this next scene is based on some actions. Emily read this one for us about how people cared for the hungry and the sick. Now, next week, we'll be able to deal a little bit more with this, but I just want to make sure we see one thing really clearly. The point of the story is not Jesus saying, you're saved based on your morality. Here's the checklist. Feed hungry people, clothe the naked, go visit those in prison and in hospitals, and you will be saved because you will have done enough things. You have to keep reading through the story. Listen to what he says as he works through the implications back in verse 39 and 40. And oh, by the way, isn't it interesting that people who are doing this don't even seem to realize they've done it? Pascal, some of you would know him, he a philosopher from long, long ago. He actually made the statement. He said, the called of God are unaware of their virtue. And those who are, I can't remember the word he used. I think he used like outcasts or enemies of God are unaware of their great sin. This is where he gets it from, right here. It's like they've done all these things and they're even unaware of what they've done. But notice what Jesus says in verse 40. Oops, sorry, lost my spot for a second. Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. The basis for judgment is not just doing a bunch of good for other people. The basis of the judgment is saying Jesus Christ is the supreme treasure. He's my Lord and he's my master. And when I serve him and when he instructs me that service of him is loving others, that is the basis of one day me standing before him. It's not anything different than the gospel that we have come to know and love. Places like John 3, verse 36, that says, whoever believes in the Son who has life. You want to know what the next statement is? In fact, play a game with me real quick, and then we'll do communion, and then I promise to end. You don't have to say it out loud. You just have to think for a second. It's two parallel statements in John 3, 36. Whoever believes in the Son has life. Whoever, and this is the part you're going to get to fill in, whoever that does not enter into life. You would think the answer should be whoever does not believe. But the answer Jesus gives is whoever does not obey. Because there is this consistent teaching of Scripture that when we truly believe him, we will act on what he says. That's what true faith. That's why James is like, faith that doesn't work itself out in some way. It's not actually faith. You can call it faith, but it's not true faith. And here we have Jesus saying, when we truly believe in him, we will act upon it. It will look like a transformed life. And the evidence of that transformed life becomes the evidence of us knowing him and him knowing us. Next week, we'll pick up there. I do apologize, kind of leaving it a cliffhanger moment like that when there's still more to go in this passage.